Did I tell you that my wife is pregnant?
No.
Yeah, she's due April 25th.
Yay. Another Mond.
What do you mean, yay, another Mond? Come on.
No, that was sincere yay.
I thought you were being sarcastic. I'm trying to create a small army of little podcasters.
Okay, that's a bit scary.
Just a bit. I agree. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic. Amazingly, episode 25, Kirsten. A monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm one of your hosts, Ian Mond, for the 25th time, and to my left is Kirsten.
What's so special about 25?
It's a quarter of a century.
Only if we're doing one once a year. No. Yeah, can we do one once a year?
Or record 12 in a month and then release them. Could you imagine that if we just took a day off and just did 12 podcasts and just went bunk fuck?
We'd need 2 days.
Why?
Well, they tend to be a couple of hours each.
Yeah, so that's a full day.
Oh, like a full day. Yeah. Oh,
so by the 12th podcast, we're hallucinating. I mean, I don't do caffeine, but I would for this. I'd get migraines, so I'd be having oral flashes.
Well, you still know I'm really keen to do my 24-hour podcast people idea at a convention, don't you?
Yes, I know you're keen.
Yeah.
I also know you're insane because that is a fucking stupid
idea.
No.
It's a really good idea.
No, it's not.
Tag team podcasting.
It's not.
24 hours. Awesome.
No one will listen to it because that'd be stupid. And you know a good 12 hours will just be people saying gibberish because at 4 o'clock in the morning, what is there to say? What is there to say at 4 in the morning?
I don't know.
In a stinky hotel, stinky conference room in a hotel, because it's not like you're outside watching life walk by. You're in one of those overlit little conference rooms. No one will be in there because they'll all be asleep.
It's not everybody for 24 hours.
No,
we
know
tag
that.
Team.
But the people who are on for that period will kill themselves.
Well, they might have an audience to ask some questions.
Oh, yeah, 4 in the morning, that's right.
You never know. I've seen the people who walk around at 4 a.m.
Yes, fandoms full of people who sit in rooms at 4 in the morning to ask podcasters questions.
Anyway, this podcast is not about that crazy idea.
No, thank God. And part two of it.
Part two.
So if you didn't join us last month, and why would you be joining us this month if you didn't, we did part one where we deconstructed, took apart and destroyed.
Oh, we did not.
Well, we weren't very helpful. We weren't very friendly to Angel Fall. We were a lot more friendly to Anti-Copernicus, though we spent more time talking about Adam Roberts as a Roberts blog essay and misquoting him than
this
the actual
is what
book.
Happens.
And we spoke about the Dark Wife, where I possibly missed the point about Greek myths. Now we're going to talk about The Black God's War, The Silence of Medea, and paintwork. And we're going to start off with, because we're getting straight into this, piss farting around. Because I haven't seen my wife in 3 weeks, and she wants to see me. Is The Black God's War by Moses Sirigar III, which was recommended by friend of the podcast, Paul Weimer.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it was. And I read his review, and it was lukewarm.
Yes. I did too.
So I, in retrospect, was wondering why he recommended this book.
From memory of his email, it wasn't exactly "you must read this." Just thought it was more really here's a suggestion of something I've read recently. But yes, lukewarm sums up his review, Paul's review, perfectly. And I think he was kind to the book.
So we should probably say before we continue what the book's about.
Yes, I think we should.
Do you want to read the blurb? Oh. In italics there.
Okay, I'll do that. Against the backdrop of epic warfare and the powers of 10 mysterious gods, Lucia struggles to understand the Black One. Her father king wants war. Her messianic brother wants peace. The Black God wants his due. She suffers all the consequences. King Vieri is losing his war against the lands of Paolon, feeling abandoned by his god. He forces his son Kao, the kingdom's holy savior, to lead his army. Victory ought to come soon. To counter Kao's powers, Paolon's prince enters the conflict. Rao is a gifted sage, a master of spiritual laws. He joins the Raja to defend their citadel against the invaders, but Rao's ideals soon clash with his army's general. The Black One tortures Lucia nightly with visions promising another 10 years of bloodshed. She can no longer tell the difference between the waking world and her nightmares. Lucia knows the Black God too well. He entered her bed and dreams when she was 10. The Black One watches, waiting to see Lucia confront an impossible decision over the fates of 2 men and 2 lands. That's far, far too long. And I'm not sure it does the story any benefit. Anyway, that's what it's about.
Well, first off, you didn't finish it.
No, I got through 94 pages and gave up.
Wow, that's only a quarter.
I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't deal with it anymore.
So why? What was the point?
Well, you finished it.
No, but I'm just saying, I have issues. What was the point
There wasn't a specific scene. It's mostly the introduction of one of the female characters.
Okay.
Narayani, yes. Yep. She was such a terrible sort of vaguely cheerleader, duncey, blondie, you know, all the worst blonde joke sort of character. In a sense, at least from the point I read, I know things get pretty dark later on the book, according to you. We'll talk about that later. Mm. At least that point seems to be comic relief for the sake of comic relief. And it was such a bad depiction of a woman.
Yeah.
So badly handled, I thought, I am not going to read this. And yes, I did have a squiz at some reviews who said that her characterization only got worse. And I thought, I'm done.
It did only get worse.
Yeah, so I'm done.
And the fact that great swathes of it were from her point of view but didn't feel genuinely from her point of view didn't help.
And the other main female character who is the black god's something or other, I mean, again, it's a bit of a blur. Lucia. She's such a one-note dull character that there wasn't anything there and everyone else is just blur. I mean...
You loved this book.
I would have stopped at page 10 if I wasn't going to give it a shot. So I did read a quarter of it because it's about 400 pages long.
Yeah,
and there's this bit.
It's the longest one we had to read.
There's this bit where one of the main characters is a healer and he's healing people in the city, and we suddenly get this point of view change. It's a separate chapter of a completely new character who's in the city, and it's sort of trying to make out that he might be an assassin. But really he's just someone else who wants to be healed. And that person then dies. So we get about 2,000 words of him. Now
there are a few little throwaway POV characters who die.
But this is in the first 10 pages of a novel.
Yeah.
When Stephen King does it, because he does it quite well in a novel, he usually does it quite a way through, and usually it's the most amazing thing you've ever read, and you could easily take that bit out and turn it into a short story. But there's a bunch of these in Stephen King. Just little snapshot characters that could be taken out, put into a book.
Yep.
Not this one. This one was dull and made no sense and didn't go anywhere. And what shat me was a couple of people who reviewed it on Goodreads said, it sets up this whole sense that that the book is going to be not what you think. You know, you think he's going to be an assassin, but really he's just a guy who wants to be healed and never appears again. Isn't that just mind-blowing? No.
No.
No, that's terrible structure. That's terrible structure. That doesn't work. That any editor worth their salt would have said, I think you're trying to be a bit too smart there. Remove that. That's not needed.
Yeah, there's a lot in this book that is not needed. It's 400 pages.
Which actually compared to most fantasy novels isn't that much.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I don't think we can complain for its length because 400 pages, you know, big deal. It's just if the prose and I
– Well, 400 pages of that book, big fucking deal.
Yeah, no, true. And the prose is terrible. I think – look, it's quite clear to the – because I did skip to the afterword because that's sometimes where all the good stuff is. And it's very clear to me that Moses has spent a long, long time on this book.
He has, and he had three separate people edit it.
Yes. I'm not going to be an arsehole and knock those people for being poor editors, although structurally they failed. But he spent a long time. He did a novella, which also he put out on the Kindle.
Yep, and I think that's for free.
Yes, which you, and
I think it's still for free.
If you are thinking of buying this after our hack and slash, I'll buy the novella first. It's very, I mean, this is 121,000 words, and it's very clear he has spent a long time on this, but that doesn't escape the fact that the words on the page are, for the most part, terrible. Where this man can use an adjective, he'll throw it in.
Yeah.
And we will quote some passages out to you, especially Kirsten. And I am honest, because considering I know how you are, and that I gave up, I'm shocked that you finished. And I'm glad you did to an extent, only because it means that we are giving a full-rounded
Well, that's why, because you had already told me that you had not finished it. And I thought, I should finish it. I looked at it as endurance reading.
Yeah. I mean, funny, because with the last podcast we talked about difficult reading, this is not what we're referring to.
No, this is difficult reading. This is difficult reading, and it's not – no, exactly. This is just arduous. I found it really, really arduous.
So do you want to explain why rather than just us saying terrible things without context. Because if I was the writer, I'd go, well, you know, fuck you guys. Why is it shit? And to be fair to Moses, he does say in his afterwards that he wants people to be honest about their reactions to the book. He's going to get a very honest reaction.
I think so. Okay, well, you can start on the very base level of the prose itself, which is incredibly overwritten. As you said, an adjective pretty much for every noun. Lots of exposition, but not interesting exposition. Like some of the stuff you'd actually be more interested in knowing about doesn't really get explained.
Such as?
The whole, like, the gods on another planet. And I don't know, like just
the gods are on another planet.
Yeah, there's a reference to them. Their planet is called starts with a G. I can't remember.
Okay.
The whole I don't know. They're just the world didn't feel like a real world. The world felt very much like it was set up to service the plot and not
or a thought experiment about
two societies. Yeah, yeah.
Parts of it want peace, but they fight anyway.
I couldn't feel that world came together. I guess,
the Western side, the sort of faux Western side,
yeah,
the faux subcontinent Middle Eastern side.
Yeah, that's okay. And I mean, I guess for me, being as this is a fantasy book, where the world kept falling apart over and over as the two sides came in contact with each other and battled, is you've got the one side which has Lucia and Kao, and they believe in the pantheon of these 10 gods, and the other side which has Rao and what was his friend?
You're asking me.
Sorry,
you're wasting your time.
Yeah,
Oh no, I got to that section. I got to the other side.
I forget his friend, like the other sage's name, and Narayani. Are you?
Yeah.
So they're more like, I guess, sort of a not like kind of Buddhism, kind of. Well, they don't believe in gods. They believe in karma and yes. And they have magic and stuff. But I mean, the problem is, like, the gods are manifest.
Yes, like, they're real.
It's quite easy for you to say I don't believe in gods when there's no evidence of gods.
But isn't it just they're not my gods?
No, but they don't believe in them. They think it's all superstition on the other guys. But hang on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, but there are
they're all about superstition and stuff, but the gods are like they see the gods. You can't think they're superstition when there's the god of the storm making the storm right there in front of you.
Yes, because I did read to that point that god does turn up.
Yeah. And the karma mystic Buddhist guys aren't going, oh no, it's just a storm. They just are saying it. They're going, oh no, they're god of the storms making the storm. So how do you not believe in a god when the gods are manifest? That's just stupid. Like, if you don't believe in those gods, you may not like them. What? You may be philosophically opposed to them.
Yeah, I think that's what he's trying to say. I don't think he's saying that they don't exist because obviously you're right, that's patently stupid.
But they're talking about this other side having
belief
superstition.
As in, I will not put my belief.
No, because they're talking about superstition all the time. It's superstitious. We'll soon show them that how you know their superstitions are wrong.
Yeah, but I still think, not having read the other 300 pages, I still think that's a commentary on that they've yes, their gods are real, but that it's the wrong side to choose more than it's not in they're not existing. Because I mean that can't be his intent.
Well, either way, it's really stupid.
Well,
then,
sloppy.
Isn't it? If you've
it
got these
sloppy.
Massive, mega powerful gods who can and will kill you.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And just reading because I did skim a bit here and there.
Yeah.
Just reading it felt like he was trying to have his cake and eat it because he wants these two different, completely different magics, in a sense, mutually exclusive types of magics.
Yeah, to work.
To work as part of the world, but how does that even make sense?
This is what I mean. The world itself never felt like it meshed. It feels like a thought experiment. Let's take these ideas and I think the author, from what I read, he's got a degree in history and religion and maybe theology too. I'm not sure, but they're the areas he studied. Yeah. And he's also said that this was sort of like a homage to the Iliad and So I don't know. There's a, it's a whole bunch of stuff that's sort of thrown in, and while there might be some interesting aspects among it, none of it gels. None of it works. I don't believe this as a real world. I just don't. It doesn't feel like a real world to me.
And again, and it's another book where everything is so po-faced. No one laughs. No one jokes. There's no humour. There's nothing. It's all my honour and my duty and bloody blah. And the only piece of comic service is that the narrowly, I'm
the girlfriend.
The girlfriend. And it's terribly done, and she just comes off as a bimbo. And
yeah,
we get enough of that in our lives. I don't have to read it in my fiction.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing that...
What happens to her?
It's not...
Well, finish your first thought.
It intertwines with what you asked, because this is what I'm not a huge fantasy reader of this type of epic third world fantasy.
Yep.
And one of the reasons I'm not is I find and I've read some really good ones, but I find a lot of it I just get bored with and frustrated, I guess, with. You're writing fantasy. You're writing another world. You literally can write whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be our world. It doesn't have to relate to our world.
Or be an allegory of our world.
It doesn't have to be any of that.
Yeah.
So I just get really frustrated with supposed third world fantasies that just fall back on, you know, our world politics, our world gender systems, our world ideas of what stuff is. And there's a valid way of you write that sort of stuff to critique what's happening in our world, and okay, that's fine. A lot of them don't, but that's one way to do it. Another way to critique what's happening in our world is to provide an alternative.
Yep.
And I've read some, but I read so few books that do that. And it's a lot of the time it comes out of science fiction. One of the books that we actually did talk about, and I think I mentioned this on the podcast, when we talked about Embassy Town by China Miéville, one of the things that I found once I realized it, because it didn't ping straight away because it's quite subtle, but one of the things I loved about Embassy Town and what he did there was the complete absence of gender politics.
Oh, okay.
They just weren't there.
Yep.
It didn't, and I only realized it because I kept, as the narrative went on, I kept waiting for Avis to run up against, and I realized that at some point I realized what I was expecting her to run up against was the fact that she was a woman in a powerful position doing stuff, and I kept expecting her to run up against resistance for that, and she never did, and it was awesome because that just wasn't part of that world. It just wasn't there. The whole gender politics gone. And it was fantastic. It was fantastic to read that without any commentary on it. There was no commentary on it. There was no, things are so much better now. We've gotten rid of the whole men-women equality thing. It was just presented. And you didn't even have to notice it to like the book. It was just this aspect of it that once I twigged to it, it was like, that is fucking awesome. And I would love to see more of it, especially, I mean, this fantasy seems to me to be such a rich mine for stuff like this because, as I said, you are creating anything you want, any political system you want, any social system you want, any cult, you are creating that.
Yeah, but it's not easy though.
I'm not saying it's easy.
It's much easier to file off the numbers
of course it is.
Japanese, Chinese cultures, which is what...
But as we were saying, do we like easy books or do we like difficult books? I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying anyone can do it. But, you know, maybe not anyone can write a book. But this is the thing. It shouldn't be easy.
But this doesn't even work. I mean, it just doesn't even attempt to do anything.
No, it's not because he's quite explicitly taking... I mean, one of
the battle tactics in this make no sense either because he's so desperate to get his divide one and two. And considering all the power that's going on here, this battle should be over 15 minutes in, but they've been fucking fighting with this wall in the way or whatever, or this barrier because they're up on a...
I have to admit, I didn't really follow a lot of the battle stuff. I probably skimmed some of that.
Well, someone does say in one review I read is that it gets a bit Dragon Ball Z after a while.
Yeah. You know, so it's like, I don't know. I just.
But I hear what you're saying, that if that's all we're falling back to.
And if this book is.
What's the point of fantasy?
If this book is commenting. Because I guess one of the things he's trying to comment on is the idea, which is an interesting idea, which I don't think he actually does very well, but the idea that in every battle, you know, neither side sits back and thinks, well, we're the evil people, we're out to do evil today. Like, every side thinks that they're on the side of good, they're on the side of right. So to write a book where you have, you know, an attempt, in a sense, to have no antagonist side.
Yeah.
So you've not got the good guys against the bad guys. You've just got two sides who, and you get equal point of view, and they both think they're right and they're good. But I don't think he quite pulls that off.
Because you don't believe in the either culture.
You don't believe in the world, and also, you know, basically, you're kind of assholes on both sides, really. So, yeah.
So you've got no one to. Yeah, you're right. And
So I don't know. Like, finish
what
it.
What happens to?
Oh, Narayana. Oh, okay. So, from what you've read, you've got the context that she's this presented as.
Well, I groaned because she's first. We find her first in bed with Rayo, I think, is her boyfriend, and you know she's upset that he's leaving.
Fiance.
Upset that he's leaving. Yeah. She wants to enjoys his warmness. Anyway. The men, him and his friend, are going off to war.
Yes.
And you know, you
and she doesn't want him to go. She wants him to stay home and, you know, get lovey-dovey.
But you're a silly girl and we're going to go off to war.
Yes.
So what happens? They go off to war and she stows away, but we don't know this, and then pops her head up and goes, I'm here. I've come to war with you. And that's when I thought, yes, I don't want to read this anymore because that's just fucking stupid. That really is honestly fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And if that's going to be the level of intelligence – Yeah, and so then what happens?
And the two prince guys, so Kao and Rayo, they're like, they've got the same sounding names.
Oh my god!
Kao and it might be Rao. Kao and Rao.
Yeah.
So Kao and Rao, the two princey guys, they make it, it's complicated, but they basically decide, instead of doing this big war between everyone and people dying and it's all bad, us two, as the two powerful sort of regents to the throne, we will just fight. And whoever wins, that's it. Like, that's how the conflict is decided.
Yep.
And neither side really thinks the other side will honour that, so they've kind of all got backup plans, but that's the thing, right? So these two guys, they'll just go and fight with no help or assistance from anyone. They'll just do it, and whoever wins, that's it.
So how is that not a shorter book? What else is going on?
Because Narayani interrupts the fight, and because she uses the power stuff. And
what power stuff?
Well, she gets taught some of the magic so she can make herself invisible.
Okay.
So she goes because Rao's about to be killed. So she goes and rescues him, and so that kind of violates the thing. And so she gets captured by the side, and Lucia gets captured by the other side. And so you've got the two female characters getting captured and threatened with rape from
what?
Yeah, because Lucia gets captured. And the king sends a message back saying, well, if you don't do this, we'll rape your daughter. And Narayana gets captured because she's just a whore. Because in the book, she's the daughter of a whore and she's presented as very sexual. I mean, she has sex. She's right. And she's very sexual and bubbly and busty and wears revealing clothes and all that sort of stuff. And there's a few lines, well, you shouldn't wear that sort of stuff. Not around the men. So she's presented this very sexualized, sort of, airheaded, love,
in an empowering
relation
way.
Obsessed.
Not sexualized in an empowering.
No. Relationship obsessed
okay.
woman. So she gets captured by KO's side because she interrupted this contest. And
you want to just call them side A and side B?
We kind of could, couldn't we? Anyway, and I'll just, before I go on, I just, You know when I said how that you get the point of view of, and it happens with it, with her, it also happens with Lucia, and it happens several times, and I just stopped highlighting them because it became just really irritating. But I'm going to read you one line. So this is from Lucia's point of view, actually, but there's other ones from Nariaya as well. So this is a scene from Lucia's point of view. Lucia, and she's got blood on her clothes.
Okay.
Right? Lucia scrubbed at the obstinate stains. Once certain she'd washed the blood away, she dragged the sopping cloth along the firm contours of her beige skin and recalled a bitter montage of recent dreams. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know about you. I don't tend to wash myself and think, I am wiping this cloth over the firm contours of my beige skin. It's like, that is not her point of view. That is someone watching her.
That's a voyeuristic point of
view.
Yeah.
And a male point of view.
Yes.
Right? And there's just bits, like really clumsy ways of showing skin color like that. And that's just one example, but I mean, I swear
adjectives.
I have.
How many words seriously could you cut from that bit just there?
Yeah, it's just.
It's full of that sort of, and that is really,
and that's, and that
101 writing
recurs
issues.
Over and over.
What, we're talking about the point of view,
where you have descriptions of the female characters, almost exclusively. I think there was one or two of the men where you went, but they weren't this sexualized description.
Yeah.
You get that from the female characters and you think, I don't like, you know, firm contours, beige skin, really, come on. So you don't really feel, you still feel like you're observing them even when you're in their point of view a lot of the time. So Nariaya gets captured by the other side and young Kaio decides he likes the cut of her jib. And
no, this is not her fiance. This is the other.
This is
side.
the hero from the other side. And I got the impression that for all her, you know, airheadedness, she loves Rayo. Like she loves him.
Yeah.
I mean, she's also thinking, you know, he's the prince. She'll have a good life with him. But she does genuinely.
That's why she followed them
love
into
him.
War.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. She went to care for him, to protect him, because she's a healer as well. She can heal. So you know. So she genuinely loves this man and wants to marry him and, you know, that came across to me as genuine. So when she's kidnapped by the other side and she's with the guy who tried to kill the man she loves, who now takes a bit of a shine to her in a nice way because we like Kao, he's good.
He's not rapey rape.
No, he just says, I'll protect you. Like, but, you know, there's a thing and she feels a thing too and suddenly she's got feelings for Kaio.
And I think he does a love triangle.
Well, yeah.
Because it's not really
there's this proto kind of love triangle.
Because love triangles only work when everyone knows the triangle exists.
Yeah, but Rayo doesn't know. He's not there. And it's like this immediate thing and it's like, why does she suddenly think this guy's okay?
Because he's awesome.
Apparently. But anyway, so she gets, you know, kidnapped and the king threatens her again, you know, he threatens to rape her actually. And Kaio says he'll protect her and then Kaio has to go away and do battle stuff. And when he comes back, he's told that she's been taken away and given to a soldier.
What's the line?
The line? Yes. Okay, so he gets back and he's told he says, where is she? And a soldier says to him, she was taken at the direct orders of the king. Where? By God's where? Another soldier spoke up. She was awarded to Pexaro, who we've not met before, but he's some soldier, obviously. And then here's Kaio's reaction, which I'm assuming the first sentence is metaphorical. Kaio's gut split apart as if a crevasse opened through his insides. He bent over and vomited onto the ground.
First off, the crevasse is funny.
Well, so he's so...
It's all about him.
And I thought, okay, he obviously really liked her and he's been struck this physical blow of, oh, my God, what's happening to her?
Yeah.
Anyway, so he says, when did this happen? And the soldiers say, oh, this morning. And so then we have Kaio took the clean cloth from the soldier because the soldiers have brought him a cloth to wipe up the spew. And he drank from the offered water skin and spit onto the ground, his mind filling with rage. He began to run back to the tent where his father was dining, beset with nauseating pangs of betrayal. So he's actually not feeling ill because the girl is probably being raped right now by Pexaro.
Yeah.
But because his father, who said, yeah, okay, you can look after her, I won't worry about her, has betrayed him.
Yeah.
That's why he's vomiting.
Yeah, but why?
But we like Kaio. Yeah, but we like him.
Shouldn't he be running off to get punch Pixaro or something?
He's
just gone off to the dad to say.
Yeah, he goes to Kaio to his father and you know says.
So she does get raped. That's the point.
Well, okay. So then what happens is he goes to confront his dad, the king, and says, you know, you said I could have her, and his dad said, oh well, I didn't think she was any good for you, and Pixaro, and. And Kaio says, well, I want her back. And the king says, okay.
And they're all talking in that sort of voice. Okay.
So then we have a scene from Narayani's point of view, which begins. Narayani lay nude, curled on her side. For a start, the word nude, wrong in that context. She's naked. Anyway, bear that in mind with the next few lines. Narayani lay nude, curled on her side on a dirty rug inside the accursed resin tent, staring at the sagging white ceiling. The men behind her continued laughing and bragging about the number of times and ways they'd violated her. So that's our introduction to Narayani, who's just been gang raped by a whole bunch of soldiers.
So he doesn't show you the actual rape.
This is the aftermath, right? Anyway, so then, you know, there's a commotion, people come in, she thinks no more, you know, just kill me. And they say, no, we're coming, you know, the king has ordered us to come, and they dress her in a robe. But you see how I mean, like, the word nude is wrong in that context?
When did you say,
She lays nude?
Why is the root, why, no, well, explain.
Nude is a soft word, it's okay. An elegant word. You paint a nude, someone is, I mean, she's not nude, she's probably lying there beaten. She's just been raped by a whole bunch of men who are still standing and laughing.
Yeah, you know,
like she's naked, she's stripped, she's...
But again, do you expect three editors to have picked that up?
Yeah. Anyway, so she's screaming, they take her back to Kaio's tent. And he says, you know, and he kneels beside her and says, I'm going to take care of you, no one will ever harm you again. And she says, kill me, I don't want to live anymore. And he... You know, he can do this calming thing with his hands, this sort of this energy. So he does that and she feels a bit calmer. And she kind of goes to sleep. And then we have...
We're still going.
No, that's the end of that chapter. And then, see, this other really annoying thing happens with this book, and it's a really badly structurally managed thing where... You'll have a scene that happens and then the next chapter will begin and it was like, oh, an hour earlier or earlier that morning. So you like things that have happened at the same time, but just this little word in italics that happens at the beginning of a chapter. It's like it's a really clumsy way of managing time and structure and overlapping storylines. Well, and when it happens like, you know, an hour earlier, that sort of thing, it's like, no.
You don't really need to have said that. Yeah, it's only if it's...
Like you can just... Yeah. Anyway.
In fact, you don't have to give a temporal indication if it's less than, you know, an hour.
No, exactly.
It may as well be running contemporaneous.
Yeah. You know. And there's ways of working it into the prose. And, yeah, I mean, other people do it as well. And it's just clumsy and lazy and anyway. So that was an aside. Because I'm just trying to find the next bit. Because now after she goes to sleep, having been brought back to Kaio.
And calmed down by his special touch.
His special touch.
Oh, it's interesting that she allows him to touch her.
And, well, the next chapter that we have her...
It's not the next chapter, it's the next chapter.
No, it's about three or four chapters, but it's again prefaced by earlier that morning. So Narayani awoke in Kaio's bed, cuddled in his arms.
So she's woken up in his arms.
In his arms. Cuddled in his arms. Also an awkward word. Her body shivered from a sudden rush of energy before her mind and body sunk into a profound calm. She remained aware of the trauma within her but felt numb to its sting. Kaio's healing powers had deadened her raw emotions and restored sanity.
Sorry? Yeah. Sanity?
Sanity.
So she'd gone, the rape had made her go a bit insane?
Yes.
Like a crazy girl?
Yes.
See, I mean, this is borderline.
Anyway. She rolled over and rested her forehead against Kaio's, which I've got to say, really intimate gesture.
You've just been raped. We've got to put in context. She's just been raped.
Like the night before,
yeah.
She was gang raped by the soldiers of this guy.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how much you love this person, and she's only just met him. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fucked up. I'm sorry. It is.
Anyway, how are you feeling? He asked. You can't leave me alone again. Never again. She pulled his body against hers and savored the warmth of his skin. Kaya used two hands to massage around her heart, with one hand on her chest and the other on her back. And he asked her about if she can use her ability to become invisible to go with him that day. And they have a little conversation about stuff again, you know. And then he says he's got to go, and he kisses her, and she thinks, stay with me, hold me, for once let other men fight. And he says, no, I've got to go. And so he goes.
Is that it? Because I'm sorry. Look, I don't mean
that. So that's kind of the aftermath of her gang rape. And anyway, so he goes, and she sort of follows him, and she watches a conversation he has with the king. And then, you know, so then Rao comes back into the picture. So she feels torn. Again, she feels torn between the man she's going to marry, who she loves, yeah, and this other guy from like the opposing side. Yeah.
It's not like she's gone a bit soft on
who?
Yeah, it's
didn't protect her. Who
on no justification, all other than the fact that he made her feel calm.
Yeah, and he's got a pretty face, I think.
There's no need to go on unless you're reaching the conclusion or climax. Because
I'll just finish. So you want to know what happened to her, right?
Oh yeah, so, okay. Yeah, anyway. Sorry.
So she's following Kaya. She witnesses Rao, who's come back into the picture, die. Kaya killed him, right? She's bereft. And Kaya steps forward and says, Nariani, it had to be one of us, either him or me. Now you can come back with me. Presumptuous.
So she's a trophy, basically.
No, because he loves her. We like Kaya. He's good.
So she's a trophy, basically.
And then, she doesn't want to go with him. And, so then... it's like everyone dies, basically. Kaya gets killed. Kaya gets killed, and then Nariani tries to kill the king, who is Kaya's dad, and she does end up stabbing him, but then the king also ends up cutting her throat, and so she dies. And as she's dying...
Rao gets killed?
She thought he was dead, and then he wasn't. And anyway, so basically she gets killed. She gets killed by the king of Rezia.
So did I do myself a service dropping out after 9?
I think you did.
You come off as...
It was just like all these...
I mean, reading his afterward, I really felt for Moses. Because I thought, you know, you've put in an effort here. You've tried to... But and it feels like, you know, maybe you're possibly kicking a puppy or something. But I couldn't get through it. And you've done a titanic effort to get to the end.
Yeah.
But if that's really how it all goes... And
it's just like none of the... Like all of the characters feel, they all feel like puppets. They all feel like they're just there to get walked through this story or this thought experiment, as you said earlier. And not just the women, the men also feel very caricaturish.
And this is book one, isn't it?
This is book one. I think there's going to be three.
Look, there's obviously a support base for this book. There are people who love it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know,
you're going to look up the Goodreads ranking.
Well, I already know. And to be fair, he's unreasonably well. There are 163 ratings with an average mark of 3.78.
Okay.
Yes, well, you obviously think that's a bit high.
I'm just.
I mean, I actually went on Goodreads. I gave it one star.
I got to say, to be fair, if I'm going to compare this book and Angel Fall, really wouldn't put one above the other.
I was able to finish Angel Fall because in spite of the fact that it has major problems, listen to our last podcast, there was some momentum to it, some narrative momentum. True. This book has no, zero, nada narrative momentum.
Yeah.
And I just lost faith in the writer to be able to produce reasonably interesting characters. Now, that's my opinion. No, look, so people love it, good on them, but really I think it fails. But not just – in terms of the characters, just on the writing, on the 101, the sort of, you know, fiction writing 101, the use of the constant adjective use should have just been cut and cut and cut.
The writing itself is really florid, and Yeah, I was actually surprised when I read the afterword and he's talking about how it went through three editors and a proofreader. Now, the proofreading, yeah, proofreading's fine. I couldn't really see any, like, errors, like, literal errors.
If I'm not going to say that about all the books, there's a couple of typographical errors. Yeah,
proofreading is fine.
In The Dark Wife, but basically...
But I'm quite surprised that this went through editing processes. Just because on a prose level, it's not good.
And to be fair, one of the people who edited his book has a small sample at the end of the novel, which I had a look at, and is very similar in style.
Mm.
So, I mean, my concern is, and look, who the fuck am I, but it's that there's a circle of these self-published genre authors who are handing around each other's books to each other, and so a number of the mistakes that a recognized editor would pick up are just not getting picked up.
Yeah,
because possibly. No editor would allow some, especially to use the constant adjectival use, unless a person was, you know, Robert Jordan and had been in it for 30 years and could just get away with whatever. A first author would not get away with
good.
That. No, it's still not good, but a first author just shouldn't get away with that. And I think, look, I get the feeling that it's just passed the book around and it's not helping the writers, in my opinion. Although, as I said, he's workshopped this, worked on it forever, done a novella. So, no, it just didn't. It's more than just it didn't meet our expectations. I think it is a terrible novel.
Yeah, no, it is.
I mean, the rape stuff is offensive. It is genuine. I mean,
It's a sexualized young girl who is raped because of the fact that she's a sexual young girl.
Go read Jim Hines' article on how rape should be used in fiction.
Horribly raped. And then the aftermath of it is really, the aftermath is really nothing. She might have stubbed her toe. I mean,
yeah.
And that, I think that's the problem with it. It's not that you can't use rape in fiction. It's not that you can't, depict it. And I mean, and it's how you use it. It's how you explore.
It shouldn't be used for the characterization boost of other characters. It should be about that character being raped. And it sounds like A, she's cured of it near instantly, and B, it's more about, oh, I was betrayed by my dad because he went and gave it to her the other bloke.
And he's a character we're meant to be on board with.
And as I said, if you read Jim Hines' article, I think it was in Apex magazine a few months back, actually might have been even 2011. It was in 2011. That points out what the do's and don'ts of writing rape scenes in books, and what mostly says, unless you know what the fuck you're doing, do not do it.
Yeah,
and be really careful. And I just don't. And I think it's just used too easily as, oh, it's a bit grim and dark, so let's throw a bit of rape in. Anyway,
yeah, and as I said, just really clumsily handled on a language level, on a structural level as well. So, is there anything else you wanted to say?
No, let's
leaving
move
that
on.
One go. No, okay,
I think we've done our job.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately.
Some will call it a hatchet job.
Double thumbs will, down.
Others will just never talk to us again. So the second book, because it's now around about 5 o'clock in the morning here in Melbourne.
Oh, stop it!
Is another one I didn't finish.
I know,
but I got through a lot more of this than I did of The Black God's War. It's The Silence of Midair by Andrea K. Hurst. And this was recommended by Tahani Wesley. Sorry, Tahani, but I didn't finish it. You were probably going to mention this, but it did get nominated for Best Fantasy in 2010 for the Aurealis Awards.
Yes.
Also, it was actually pointed out.
It was shortlisted.
Yeah, shortlisted. Yeah. I said nominated, so yeah. Also pointed out to us on our website by someone who was by a listener who's reading on with us, that it is actually the first half of a book, and it's, although I haven't
been
an issue.
It's book one of a duology.
Yeah, but I think the feeling I get reading some reviews as well is that it literally is the, I don't know how it ends because I didn't finish it, but I don't know if it ends in a way that feels
it just ends very abruptly.
Yes, and that's the point, that really you're meant to pick up book two straight away because it's.
Yeah, well,
the problem is it's not packaged that way.
No, and my view on that is if that's what you're doing, then you write a big fat book.
Especially if you're
self-publishing,
novels. Correct, and I don't understand.
Well, not they don't necessarily have to stand alone, but each book has to be satisfying in itself.
Absolutely, and unless you've got some history there that I'm not aware of, I don't see why you wouldn't just publish one book if you're doing a self-published work anyway. I mean, the book itself is about 240 pages long, because Kindle does tell you how long these things are. Well, some Kindle titles do.
So
let's assume they're both double the same size.
So you'd have a book the size of The Black God's War.
But 100 pages long, about 500 pages. Yeah. But it's Kindle. It's so wide. Yeah. You know, I mean, or iBooks.
Well, before we continue, we should I'll just read the précis of the book.
All right.
That I've gotten from.
You don't want me to do it again, because I did such a good job with Black God's War.
No, I'm going to do this one.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So, time stole victory. Medea and Rhenestar returned too late to drive back the Abyssian invasion, centuries too late. When friend and enemy have become the same thing, what use are the weapons Medea planned to use to protect her empire? There is no magic, no artifact, no enchanted trinket which can undo the past. But no matter how Medea wishes to hide from the consequences of her failure, there are those who will not allow her the luxury of denying the present. Her war is already lost, but she carries weapons which could change the course of new battles. With the skirmishes of war beginning and hunters in near pursuit, it is her conscience Medea cannot escape. Whose side should she be on? What is she really running from?
That's actually not a bad blurb.
It's not bad.
It's much better than one of the
before. Okay, enough now.
No, sorry. Well, it is. It's a better blurb. Can I just say one thing? The Black God's War's got a great cover. I love the cover of Black God's War. Really professional looking cover.
Yep.
I'm not entirely convinced by the cover for The Silence of Medea. No, I'm not entirely sure if that's a pretty. It's a cover of what looks like a frightened girl clutching a satchel. Now, I assume that frightened girl is.
She's meant to be Medea.
Medea, but
yep.
The story doesn't really characterize Medea as someone who'd be a frightened girl clutching a satchel with her back to a door and light. Slightly shining through the cracks. So that was a bit of an odd that was an odd choice just to begin with. And yes, the reason why I didn't finish it.
Yes, why didn't you finish it?
Because I found it dull.
No, tell me what you really mean.
You know how I was saying before about Angelfall having some momentum?
Yes.
And how Black God's War didn't?
Yes.
This definitely doesn't. Didn't. This never gets out of gear one.
It is a very flat narrative.
It's not helped by the fact, you know, most of us laugh at maps in fantasy books.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever said that this.
You wanted a map?
Yeah, because unfortunately what she does is she spends a good 25 pages in the beginning just burdening you with exposition about the world.
There's a lot of exposition in this, like so much exposition.
It's not organic at all.
No. She'll take, the narrative proper will be going along and then you'll kind of get sidelined into, explain for a couple of pages about this.
It starts with Medea. Basically, these people have come and she's out in the hill. She's secluded away in a forest up on a hill base or mountain, basically. And a bunch of people from across the border have come to get her. So in the midst of that, them coming to get her and her escaping, there's all this exposition about partly who she is. The fact that she went to get this horn in a maze, for some reason went to sleep and woke up 500 years later. All that's given to you in that first 25 pages.
Yeah.
So it kills any mystery or suspense of the scene itself.
And then it is reiterated
a million times
throughout the book.
And I just lost. I just stopped. I did get to the conflagration, which is probably the big set piece of the novel.
Yeah.
But even that just didn't feel interesting. And it's not helped by fantasy names that are impossible to pronounce or remember. Look, I know this is a critique that a lot of people who don't read fantasy give of fantasy books,
yeah.
But this is the example. Long names that are forgettable and hard to remember. And she does try to shorten them throughout the book. Like, so she'll give you the full title. It's Coribus Alcillary Fully.
Yeah.
Good. Blah, blah, blah. And then she'll go, oh, it's Coribus. But, it just did me in.
Yeah.
You finished it though.
I finished them all. I decided I had to.
Did you would you have given up on this one, or do you think I'm being too harsh? You haven't disagreed with me.
Yeah, no, I think I in the general scheme of things I would have, if it had just been a book I'd picked up, I wouldn't have gotten very far. I don't think I would have gotten to 90 pages.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I kept going because I'd already given up on one. I thought I should
really.
There
was there were really interesting things in it that I quite liked. I just thought. I mean, you're asking about the backstory. The backstory actually, it's I went to her website and she's got this, it's hilarious. She's got this amazing transcription of all these emails that went back and forth between her and an unnamed publisher that she submitted the book to.
Yep.
And the publisher held on to it for 10 years.
What?
I know. And she's just got this whole swathe of the emails of her constantly going back and pinging them and saying, so, have you read it yet? And then saying, oh, well, it's past this kind of thing and we've shoved it up here and we may know something in the next. And it's just, it's tragic, but like darkly funny. And so basically, yeah, an unnamed major publisher held on to the manuscript for about 10 years, which in my opinion is like at least 8 years too long.
Yeah.
For her to have like left it with them and not withdrawn it. But it's kind of like you read the emails and you can kind of understand because they're sort of,
there's
like little carrots and little grains that they're just like throwing out there and saying, oh, well, you know, you're the only book that got through this from this particular pile. So we've put you, you know, so. And, you know, and at some point it's like, well, there's been 5 years. What's another 6 months? And what's another 6 months? So it's like that's actually worth reading as I don't think a common experience with traditional publishing, but as a sort of an outlier experience, I think. But, yeah, you can sort of see why at the end of all that she went, well, I'm not trying again. Which is basically what she said. She said she had this god-awful experience.
I don't blame her.
She was writing other things and submitting to agents and stuff, but she wasn't picked up. And when the 10-year anniversary of this came, she just went, and decided to self-publish. She said, for all the massive advantages of gaining an agent publisher, the submission process comes with not inconsiderable negatives. And frankly, the publisher she submitted to made her feel like dirt and she didn't want to go back to that. Self-publishing gave me my books on my shelves and readers have a far better chance of discovering my stories now than they did when they were still buried on my hard drive. So that makes me happy.
No. Look, if you've gone through that experience and you believe in the work, fuck yeah, publish.
Yeah.
Because I just want to say we're not against self-publishing. This is not two episodes of podcasting to shit on self-publishing.
No, not at all. So that was sort of why – that was her road, which is nightmarish. Because that was – I mean, you hear about people like taking years and years and years to have a book published, but like this is one manuscript submission at one publisher that just kept getting like pushed. But this is, I think, the problem with this book, and not that I think, like, there's no excuse for a publisher hanging onto a manuscript for 10 years or even 5 years or 3 years. Not good. But I can kind of see why they wouldn't have immediately shoved it back and said, no, it's not for us. Because there is a lot of promise in the book, but I could also kind of see why they didn't immediately go, oh, yes, we should publish this, because there's a lot of work that needed to be done to this book.
You see,
it's one of those books.
You said about Angel Fall, the world building's not convincing.
Yeah.
Even though this has billions of words of exposition, the world building in this actually works.
Yes, it does. It really
does. I bought the world building.
Yeah, the world building
and the magic
in this
magic world
is nice.
Works. Yeah, that all works. Yeah. You're right. It needed a lot more work.
Needed a lot of work. So, like I said, I can see why it didn't get rejected, and I can also see why no one was like they were kind of hanging on to it, thinking, well, maybe I don't know. I mean, I don't know what they're thinking, obviously, but I can see that internal. Or they were just incompetent. Who knows? Maybe no one read it for 10 years. Who knows? No, I don't think that's the case. That's not what happens. So it's sort of – but there's a lot of info dumping, like all the time. It got very tedious.
It just stops the narrative.
It does.
It kills it dead.
That's exactly what it does, because it's going along and then it's like, oh, and now I'm going to tell you all about this. And it's like, oh. That wasn't good, and if it's so necessary, it needs to be in there. Then you just have to weave it through your narrative somehow. You have to find a way to do that.
You were going to mention some good things, and I think one of them is the world building. I think if you love world building and you don't mind info dumping, then this is actually quite enjoyable. I think one of the other issues I had with it is I felt uncomfortable about the sort of post-colonial feel to it. So setting up the novel, you've got a civilization that their country, land, whatever, is basically been destroyed by wild magic, a blight of wild magic.
Yes.
They've gone to take haven in another country.
Yes.
The king of that country has sent envoys, which is one of them is Medea, our main character, to basically say, you're here, you've settled in this land. We'll welcome. Support you. We'll welcome. We love
we'll help you. You're refugees.
Yeah, refugees.
Right, we're more refugees. Than happy to help you. We'll do what we can to help you and assist you. And you know, it's terrible what happened to your land.
And then they turn around and go, actually, no, we're declaring war on you.
Yeah, because we can't accept your help.
Yeah.
Because that would be a blow to our cultural pride, yes, in a
that's
sense.
Right.
So if we're going to settle here, we need to conquer
and basically they do, and what happens is Medea, who spends a lot of time with the leader of this group at some point, hates that they're called the White Snakes. That's their pejorative term.
And what I didn't get, like, it was a pejorative, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was definitely a pejorative.
Yeah.
I don't think that was the problem, because
I think they use it 500 years later. They're using it as a sort of a badge. The Abyssians, or whatever they're called, that they use it more as a badge. But, yeah, it's meant to be a pejorative.
I'm
pretty clear it is. I don't think.
Yeah. And so even at the end when she's gotten to know them and likes them and all of that, she's still referring to them as white snakes.
Yeah.
And that really,
because there's that racist overtone to
it. It's definitely a racist. That's absolutely what it is.
Yeah.
And starting off that way, fine, because that's how you view these people.
Yeah.
But once you're living among them and you're friends with them and you've saved some of their lives, are you still calling them white snakes in your head?
I was certain it was meant to be a pejorative term.
But by the end I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because why is she still thinking about them like that? And that's what I mean. There's these little finesses which aren't there.
So she's gone off to find this fabled item, which if you blow it, it'll basically vanquish the baddies, okay?
Yes.
She goes amazed, has a nap, 500 years later wakes up.
Yeah.
On waking up, she discovers that she's 500 years in the future and, you know, shock horror. Not much has changed except a few villages have popped up.
Which is the one bit of world-building I actually didn't buy. Yeah. I didn't buy that. There was so little linguistic drift.
She does, although to be fair, she does mention that some words are different. And,
yeah, but 500 years, that's a long
time. It was
long
more the fact
time.
That some villages that weren't there are now there more.
Yeah.
And the fact that her king's been completely overthrown and these white snakes are now in power.
Yes.
And more importantly, there's more interbreeding.
Yes.
So there's very few purebloods of either side. So she goes in seclusion and decides, because she now has this horn, because the fabled horn does exist.
Yes.
She decides not to blow it because she can't distinguish between.
Because the world has changed.
Yes.
Like blowing it now, what would it do?
Why this book had I problems with is as a result, in a sense, the book seems to try to create the question of who's good and who's bad and all that sort of stuff. But it feels to me that she's actually made that decision in the first 10 pages of the book.
She has
but she never changes. She never doubts the view that she can't blow the horn, because if she did doubt it, she probably would have blown it before the book started. There would be no book. It was what I'm saying. Book.
She would have come out and gone.
She spent a year cogitating over this and the guilt, and she hasn't blown the horn. So you pretty much and there's no point where you feel, oh, she's wavering. She's going to take the horn out. No, she's pretty clear. She ain't going to blow that bloody horn. So where's the character arc?
Yeah, and it's also a really – well, I think that is why the book is flat, because there is no real character arc. There's not a lot of development.
Did she pull the horn out at the very end? Because
She gives the horn to – because what happens – well, I don't know. We're going to spoil it if we say what happens, aren't we?
Well, it's only
one of the things I did like about it was the thing that happens at the end after the conflagration
and what
that actually is that okay, so we're going to spoil it. So if you don't want spoilers, just turn off for a few minutes. It's not just a fire that is going to wipe out the city, which is what they think it is. What it is it's the other side, like the old people who Medea, you know, that side, they have made a magic that will just rewrite the world.
Back to the way it was 500 years
ago. So that's never happened and that they've never been.
And, of course, it does beg the question, why is this happening now, not 430 years ago.
This is how they've been able to do it. I don't know. It's okay. Happening now because now is when the story is being told. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, all right, fine.
But no, it isn't. It is funny. Like, it is a coincidence because this is when Madea is now, and why couldn't they have done it 350 years after, not 500? Or did Madea get flung out now by the magic because that's when it's about to happen? I mean, yeah, I don't know. None of that is resolved.
What's the choice she makes? Because she's passive for most of the book.
She gives the horn to the queen of the city
who
to defend against this new magic.
Oh, okay. So
she gives the coin to the Obizians.
Does she admit to who she is?
Yes.
Yes, she does. And they believe her?
Yes. And she gives – because she's got the bag of holding – sorry, the
satchel.
Satchel. Which was the one thing. It's like, oh, so she's got
her
this –
TARDIS satchel, because it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
And every time she's in a scrape, she can just reach into her bag of holding and pull something out to save the day.
Yeah,
it was really convenient and really annoying. And the one, like the bit
and
where
she's
they're
also
in,
got rings that help her teleport.
Yeah, it's like the bit when they're in the hut.
Yeah, and it's burning.
That was the bit where it actually had quite a bit of suspense. Like, and I was wondering, like, it was actually one of the scenes in the novel which had a bit of suspense and drama to it.
Yeah,
and I felt myself sort of getting a bit anxious. And how are they going to get out of this? And then she just pulls a ring out of her bag and they teleport. And it's she just got.
Well, she
a magic
tries
ring.
To amp it up by saying, well, she could end up teleporting anywhere, sort of.
But
in rock.
She basically gets out a magic ring and teleports.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
But to go back to the colonial stuff.
Yeah. It's really problematic because
there's no arc with her character.
Yeah.
And there's this whole also. See, I mean, we have Australia Day here every year.
Yep.
But some Indigenous people call it Invasion Day.
Yep.
And you know, that it's been 214 years, and who knows, you know, and maybe for another 214 years, the same thing will be said. And I say that because she's made up her mind already, and I wanted the book to actually explore that issue of the colonial stuff a lot more. I wanted her to be a lot more unsure about whether, well, yes, I know they've settled in, they've been here 500 years, they live here now, so it's all good. No, I wanted her to critique that, to go, no, it's actually not good. They took our land. We still deserve that back, but they are human beings, so I can't just kill them all. But, you know, I wanted that conflict, and it's the blurb sort of implies that it's there, but it ain't.
But the other thing is that I found, I mean, I guess particularly reading it at this point in time, and what's happening in our country at the moment is go back even further. There's what's happened is because originally the Obizians were refugees.
Yes.
And they were welcomed. And what happened when you welcomed the refugees into your land and
invited
them? Yes,
that's also, yes.
They took over your land.
Yes.
It's a really delicate.
I don't think Andrea means that.
No, I don't think so, but it's there. It's there.
It definitely is there.
And
yeah.
I think this whole thing about refugees and colonialism and who owns land and
I think it's more the Aboriginal analogue of the Aboriginals came to – sorry, the Indigenous people came to welcome the white settlers, so to speak. I mean, that's how I was taught at school anyway. And they ended up shooting them and killing them.
Yeah.
I think that's the parallel.
Yeah, but they're not an invading force though. They're a refugee force. I mean, they're not a force. Like, they're refugees. They've been welcomed and invited
into Captain
Cook
the
land.
Is an invading force.
Yes.
Yes.
They're people who want to colonize.
They're going back home, but they want to take over. Yeah. You're right. It's a subtle – it's actually not subtle.
It's not that subtle a difference.
No.
But this is a – and this – when you start – and, it you know, they're really complicated issues and there's lots of layers and lots of –
but the book doesn't do anything
with
them.
No, the book doesn't. I know. Even at the point
maybe book two does.
Maybe it does.
And that's what I – you know, and if it does, fine. People want to say, oh, no, all that's sort of dealt with in book two, great. But – I'm sorry, but actually it needs to have been dealt with in the first 250 pages because it's a major issue. It's the elephant in the room. Both those things, both the colonial side but also
I get the feeling the
refugee issue. Which
is the colonizing side is what's taken, but the way that she's set that up as that they're not an invading army. They're not people who've just come and decided they like this land and want it for themselves.
No, they're there because they're
a bunch of refugees whose homeland is the equivalent of war torn. They can't go back. Their homeland's gone. It's gone. They've got nowhere to go back to. And they've got this cultural thing of, well, we can't just be invited and welcomed and looked after. We have to conquer it. But, I mean, this is the thing that you hear so much. You know, we can't have refugees in. They'll take over the place.
Yeah.
It's like it's a really, you know, and I guess for a book that's an Australian book, you think that's there's kind of more resonance there, you know? It's like because we're having this conversation. We've been having this conversation for 5 years.
That's why I felt
about refugees and where they belong and what happens when we let them in to our country and why they can or can't go back home. And this whole conversation has been happening. And this, I just keep coming back to these are refugees. They've got a cultural thing that the author's given them. She's given them this cultural thing.
Yep. Exactly. Yes.
That they've got too much pride and they can't just be helped. But that's something the author's given them. The point is you've taken a group of refugees, you've given them these characteristics that mirror to a certain extent some of the dialogue around people who don't want refugees to be helped into the country.
It's clumsy.
It's clumsy. And I don't think – I agree with you. I don't think that is deliberate, but it's something that just has not been thought through.
And it's lines – it's sentences like Ibisians weren't invaders, not after 500 years, which she thinks. This is coming from her thinking. I'm thinking, you know, that's a big statement.
That is a big statement.
That needs to be unpacked.
Because again,
with more subtlety than just that line,
but it might. You know, but as you say, it might be in the second book. I mean, I think
that this is her thinking. Yes. This is not another character. If it was an Abyssian, or I don't know how to pronounce it, but I'm assuming it's Abyssian. If it was them thinking it, then that's one thing. But it's her. She's already set. She's already made up her mind. They're not invaders anymore. They've settled in. And look, that's not necessarily a wrong view.
Yeah,
it's not that it's completely wrong. It's just that it needs to be unpacked. It needs to be explored.
Yeah,
there's more to it than that.
And as you say, this may happen.
Yeah, look, she might look because there's reference to the Metarists. There's a mythology built around
it. Yes, I like that too. And that was nice.
But we don't get to meet them. We don't. Well, we sort of vaguely in one backflash meet them. But then
I also did like. I mean, one of the other things I liked about this book is that we have a protagonist who is, you know, she. I mean, I think she's too passive.
She's far too passive.
But we do have a protagonist who's not all argy bargy and you know she's a diplomat. She's someone who works with words and works with talking and stuff like that. She's not just pick up a sword and let's kill them all.
True, but...
But I just don't know that...
True, but her entire narrative motivation is to get back into the cave so she can sleep away her life. That's not exactly, you know, the most proactive thing in the world. And, of course, the only reason she gets involved in the plot is because the person she saves puts a spell on her.
Yes, and...
Do they fall in love, by the way?
Not at the end of this book, but it seems to be heading that way.
Yeah, okay. Yes. That's another thing I predicted. There are other nice little things as well, which, again, made me realize this is not terrible stuff.
No, it's
which
not.
Which is the fact that when 500 years previously, when she was with the previous king ruler, whatever, of this refugee group, they had a lot of very strict rules, and that king ruler emperor, I'm not going to use the terminology she uses, is an ascetic. You can't touch anyone, you can't eat certain foods, only has to wear white. And 500 years later, they've basically chucked all that in. And that sort of religious theological drift is really interesting to see that. It's not really unpacked again much, but I like that she's thought that through.
Yeah.
So the world building is spot on. I just... Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been so much more. That's what I think we're saying.
Yeah. And,
it's clumsy in some areas.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not – I didn't find it so interesting that I'm going to read the second half.
I definitely
You didn't even read the first half.
I didn't finish the first half, so.
But, you know, there was stuff I like. It's just – it's one of those things where you think it's just needed – it just needed something. And I don't know.
Look, it only got 60. It only has 60 ratings on Goodreads, but has a high overall mark. Actually, second to Angel Fall, which is the highest of 4.35. Mm. This is 4.28. When you read the reviews both on Goodreads and Amazon.com on the Kindle bit, again, a lot of people love it, and good.
There were bits I really, really liked about it.
I think there's a lot of there is something there. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's a bit flat.
As you can see, we're getting towards the end. Yes. So we are towards the end of the last book. Paintwork, it's all okay. We're done. So. No, I'll tell you what, Paintwork by Tim Morn, which, and I hope that's pronounced correctly, Tim, recommended by Cheryl Morgan. I've got to say, Tim, you've made Cyberpunk cool again because I loved your book. Now, what it is, it's very short as well. It's 108 pages.
Three stories.
It's probably my favourite thing I read. I probably like it more than the Adam Roberts. Three stories. And first off, I love the fact that it's not 15 stories. I love the fact that he's picked three stories set in a certain milieu, certain thing, and gone with those. Now, whether they're all strong is something we'll discuss.
But this
now.
Is what you can do with a digital book.
That's right. That's
not something – you wouldn't see this book on the shelf of a bookshelf.
Exactly.
And unless it was some little chapbooky thing.
Small press publisher will do that sort of stuff. Yeah. But no, Jonathan and on Coode Street – yes, I mentioned Jonathan again.
we haven't forgiven you, Jonathan.
Yes, we haven't. In a discussion with Gary, has mentioned that some authors bring out their collections a bit early and will often have, 20 stories, of which 7 are great, but 10 are and 3 are dreadful. And I like the fact, as you say, with digital publishing, it gives Tim an opportunity to bring out three stories in the same milieu that I think two are stronger than one other, but and I think we agree on that, but still are pretty decent stories and can give you then a really good piece of work where you're not thinking, well, that's a bit shit bit, and oh, there's a better one. And that's great. That's great. So that's just an overall thing. So you want to say what it's about? I mean, it's three connected, well, sort of connected stories.
Well, I mean, two are definitely connected.
The last two, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'll just give you the little précis here, shall I? So the first story, augmented reality street artist 3Cube wants to break into the mainstream, and as one of the best in the graffiti mecca of Bristol, he stands a real chance. Except that some unseen rival, seems set on using even the most old-fashioned of methods to stop him from succeeding. So that was that's the first story, which is Paintwork. Second story is Paparazzi. John Smith was successful once, if only for a fleeting moment. Now the documentary filmmaker is broke and jobless and finds himself putting his life on the line as one of the new breed of paparazzi, snapping celebrity video gamers in virtual worlds. And the last story, which is Havana Augmented, is
a nominated story.
Yes, it was nominated for the BSFA Short Fiction Award in 2010. On the sun-bleached streets of Havana, two young Cubans find themselves locked in a fierce struggle with one of the world's most powerful organizations as a seemingly innocent video game tournament becomes a fight for both personal and national pride. That third one was probably my favorite story in the collection.
It is awesome, but I don't want to jump to it straight away. Yep. First off, it's mostly cyber. It's a cyberpunk, but with probably more updated tech.
Yeah, it's like technopunk.
You're just making stuff up.
Oh now. Yeah, everyone gets to make up their own punk words.
Isn't that like music?
Yeah, but this is technopunk in literature.
Anyway, in this world, what do people say? Like the future, it's just around the corner, but it's
near future.
I know people say the near future, but it's like it's tomorrow. It's just. The next day,
it's the near future.
Okay, it's where people have spectacles, glasses, and these glasses allow you to see stuff that's not actually in the real world.
They're
such
like the
as
new Google specs. That yeah, are Google. Be coming
yeah.
Out soon.
So, what they're actually coming out with shit like this.
Yeah.
God, give me a migraine. But so, for example, you walk into as one character does in the second story, you walk into your apartment with the glasses on and you'll see post-it notes from your housemate telling you to buy the milk. If you take the glasses off, the post-it note actually isn't there. It's virtual post-it note. And that's a lovely idea. And the way he uses it in Paintwork is fan-fucking-tastic because the glasses interact with their QR codes.
Yep.
Which I didn't even know they were called QR codes until recently, before this. But did you know? I thought they were just some weird dosh de black.
Oh, everything has a name.
So anyway, if you with the specs on, if you look at the QR code, the billboard, which is just a 3D billboard, but it's just flat 2D, actually 2D, will come alive. So let's say it's a Coke one in the story. The Coke character will come off the billboard like a 3D movie sort of thing. And his job. This graffiti artist, what he does is he covers up the QR code with his own QR code, and if you put the glasses on,
they'll activate a different thing.
Activate a completely different image, and it's all about the Bristol. And it's all set in Bristol, and it's all about the decay of Bristol and blah, 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 but with a tinge of hope. And the genius of that story is that he puts it up. He's very arrogant, this guy. He puts it up, goes to bed, wakes up thinking that's going to be a buzz on the Twitters. Yep. I love how Twitter's still around and the RSS feeds are still around.
Yeah.
And finds out, no, actually, what people are all excited about is that someone has actually painted over 2D, done an actual piece of graffiti based on the image that he had come up with, but a perverted, distorted view of that image.
Yes, which is really cool.
It is. I loved it. I loved it, and I zipped through it. And talking about narrative momentum, one thing I love about Tim is that there's great storytelling here. It just zips. It moves.
Yep.
You know, I mean, yes, the main character's name is 3Cube, 3CUBE, and that, you know, sort of naming gets on my tits. It doesn't didn't matter because it just moves like a bullet train.
It does.
Do you agree?
No, I do. It's really, really clean prose, and it's not there's enough of the sort of the techno speak to evoke the cyberpunk sort of world.
Yeah.
But not so much where you're second guessing yourself every paragraph about what that might mean and what that could refer to.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's got a really great clarity of prose.
And he's used common sense terminology like specs and vert. And I mean, vert's not a new word. It's been used in, Jeff Noon said VURT rather than VIRT, but he's used common sense nomenclature to get across the slight differences rather than just weird shit for the sake of it. So, you know, there's hacking and it's just cool. I thought cyberpunk was dead, but if it's written like this 30 years later, it's actually really damn good and it feels more relevant.
I don't know the technology is pretty much here. So,
well, how does Google Specs work?
Oh, they are augmented reality glasses.
Yeah, okay.
Like exactly that. You wear them and, you know, you'll walk past a shop and the sale price of something in the shop will flash up in front of your eyes.
There's the iPhone app like Layer and things like that which you can use.
But these are glasses.
Rather than on an iPhone. Yeah.
Basically, though, you know, it's what he has in the book. It's augmented reality.
Oh, so what you're saying is that Tim hasn't come up with an original idea.
I didn't say that.
So we both agreed that the second story is probably not the strongest.
I mean, the first story, I really liked the ideas in the first story. I liked the prose. I just thought it was a little predictable.
The first story?
Yeah.
Yeah, I also picked the ending as well.
And it was like, oh, it is what I thought. Oh, okay. But, I mean,
and the same with the second story was the same way.
Yeah, the second story I thought was quite – again, I liked the sort of the basic idea, which is that – paparazzi are now going in to capture images of avatars rather than real people in the real world. They're going in game and to secure pictures of gamers' avatars.
Because the gamers' avatars are more famous than the human being that plays the avatar.
And
there are guilds based on this, and it's a very in depth. Well, and you can see it happening.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that story maybe suffered to be from being a little bit too much about the world building and less about the story.
Yeah, because John Smith, the documentary character, actually gets more characterization in the third story, and even though he only appears in it very slightly.
Yes, that's him. Yes.
Although I don't understand how he gets from the rice paddies to Cuba. But anyway, whatever. There's probably stories in between. But he's a bit of a cipher in that second story. And I think one of my other criticisms, and this is general of the collection.
Little Japanese girl?
No. Well, I think just women in general are not exactly highlighted in these three stories. There's nothing, you know, necessarily wrong with that. Women don't have to be strong characters in every story you write. But it was just interesting that this is a man. These are men's stories in a man's world, which actually probably reflects the technology at the moment. I mean, video games, I know women are moving into that, but it's still very male-dominated and it felt male-dominated in the stories.
The disappointing thing is that it reflects the perceived situation, not the actual situation.
Yes, yes.
There are lots and lots and lots and lots of women in game and writing about games in. I mean, there are lots.
And that's what's
not a fringe.
Seen that third story where we do have game playing going on.
And
there's one female character.
Yeah, and she's a cute little Japanese girl.
Yeah. So
described as such.
That was a letdown.
Yeah, it was.
It doesn't mean the third story isn't the most awesome Source story you'll ever read. Because it's got mechs fighting.
I mean, he describes
kicking ass in Cuba. but as an augmented reality. It's just genius. It really is.
Yeah, he even describes when the Japanese girl who's called Mako, and she is the only female gamer in that last story. Yes. When she loses, she throws a tantrum, quote unquote.
Yes, and there's this nasty bit also in the second story when the guy gets home and basically calls his female roommate, he doesn't say a cunt, but he gets, he may actually even say that, he gets pretty narky on her. And when there aren't that many women in the, I mean, there is a female, Claire is one of the other main characters in the second story, but she's, again, just a cipher. There's no real character to her.
See, this is the introduction of Mako.
You're going to keep going on that Mako, aren't you?
Because she's the representative, right? Okay, it's not like there are three or four women there.
Okay. Right? Yeah, go ahead.
And as you point out, she's pretty much one of the very, very, very few female representatives in the whole...
In the whole collection.
So we get introduced to Mako as saying... John Smith is introducing her, saying, "Well, the Ice Maiden over there is Mako Kobayashi," he said, pointing at a tiny Japanese girl hiding under an enormous parasol in the corner, wearing something that Paul thought was either a bondage bikini or lolicon cosplay. She's the archetypal spoilt Japanese princess. Comes from pure Zaibatsu stock. Doesn't really talk to anyone, but be careful, she's a crafty little witch.
It's not great.
Yeah, because that description of her is not undermined by her characterization later, and her tantrum throwing.
Yeah, it's reinforced.
And it's like that's the image of girls in games. And that's not girls in games.
Is that enough to make you hate the third story?
No, it's not enough to make me hate. That's not enough to make me hate the third story. Possibly the unilateral decision that Paul makes on behalf of his entire country and whether everyone in that country gets to have the stuff made me a bit annoyed. Oh, because it's presented as a really good thing, right? There's this young guy who's saying, "No, we don't want this stuff and I will fight you and it will just be you and me and no one will know. And then, you know, if I win, you will leave my country. And if I win..."
Viva la revolution.
One guy... deciding for the whole country. Well, one unelected...
That's Cuba, isn't it?
Representative
that's
deciding.
That's Cuba, isn't it?
But this is a good thing in this story.
Well...
this is a good thing.
No, well, I actually...
He makes a unilateral decision.
Yes, he does.
Stuff that's good for Paul is okay, but, like, if he doesn't like it, then no one can have it.
No, but let's be fair.
He's in the camp, it's not that bad. Like, you know, it wasn't too bad. But what about for all the other people who were there?
Was it too bad for them? In the camp or in Cuba?
No, in the re-education camp. What? There's this paragraph where he says...
Yeah, no, I know. He says he was fed well for 3 months.
And it really wasn't too bad. And I'm thinking, well, what about all the other people? Was it just you the camps aren't too bad for? Or did you think about all the other people who weren't minor celebrities and therefore weren't treated okay?
So what's your point?
My point is Paul
is
very, very self-centered and he's all about Paul and he's not really about Cuba. And he's making these unilateral decisions for his whole country in secret. And this is framed in the story as being heroic and it's not heroic.
Well, I disagree.
Okay.
I think it's a commentary on that sort of consumerism gone mad.
While
Cuba isn't exactly, you know, I mean, there are issues with Cuba, and I don't think the story hides from that because Marcus, I think it's Marcus, who's Paul's friend, you know, has to work in secret doing this game. And they do have concerns that once the work they're doing on the game leaks on YouTube or whatever, they're going to be, you know, sent to re-education camps. So there is the fear of that. But he sees the consumerism and says, "No, I'm actually going to tell these people to piss off because it's just going to ruin my country." Now you're right. So he makes a decision on his own. I agree, but
and it's a decision in secret. It's a decision in secret. I think that's the thing. Like he's not saying we'll do this, and then the people can, you know, it's a decision made in secret.
Yeah, okay, yeah, but so what?
How is that good? How is that heroic?
He doesn't know when he I'll tell you why, because he doesn't know when he makes the decision that A, the re-education camps are, for him is going to be a good experience, or not good, relative. You know, it's not going to be hell. But B, he doesn't know that his mate, Marcus, is actually going to be given a job at the university to do all this work. So he's not making that decision based on reward for himself. He is genuinely thinking at that time that he's making John Smith, who sends him the information, says, look, I'm protected. Don't worry about me, and I've got more on.
No, but he makes the decision
to have the fight,
to have the challenge, and to do it, and to that's like before any of that stuff.
No, like, but
that happens afterwards.
You're linking the re-education camps.
I wasn't conflating them. I'm saying he makes this decision unilaterally, and demands that it be made. Like, he doesn't know that it's not going to be secret, right? But this is framed by the story as a good thing, as him, yes, I'm standing up for the – but, well, how is it a good thing? How is one person unilaterally deciding the fate of his whole country a good thing and doing it in secret?
It was an awesome story. It's got mechs shooting at each other in augmented reality.
It is an awesome. I'm not. Look.
Well, you are.
It is a good story. I'm just saying there are problems with the framing in the story.
The events are.
And I think it's a lot more complicated than.
That's that solo fight, and he makes the deal that he wants them to leave if he wins. But then he embarrasses the guild by actually posting up the video of the fight.
Yes.
Which then that's my point. You're right. It is a secret decision he makes with them, but then he admits his culpability in the decision, which he's happy to do because he's done it by putting this up on the website. Because then it makes links. The reason they left is because he beat them and has now embarrassed them. Okay, and he does that, not knowing what will happen to him.
Yeah,
and that's the heroic act. You're right, he's made the decision in secret. And I suppose I was so in love with the story, I didn't see anything wrong specifically with the decision. because the society anyway isn't losing out. What they're losing out on is the overt consumerism of this guild, Sakura, whatever they're called.
Yeah.
And their products being lit up everywhere.
Yeah.
They're not losing out on the technology, though, because – although he doesn't know this at the time because it's being developed.
But they are losing out. Like, yeah, exactly. He doesn't know that. I mean, it's like the story doesn't – I guess – see, the story ends up really happily, right? I mean, he doesn't have too bad a time in the re-education camp. Don't know about anyone else. Everything works out. There's no real – I guess there's no real interrogation on any complex level of the trade-offs that you have to make, that everyone makes every day for the benefits of technology as opposed to, you know, the consumerism and the exploitation. And there's not like it, like in this story, the way it's all done, he makes this stand and he does it. And it still ends up all right in the end, poetic justice. Yay. You know, cause they're going to get it anyway, as you say, not that he knew that, but you know, there's no real.
But isn't the critique in the fact that when he goes to see his father or grandfather or uncle, I forget, the old man in the room, I think it's not his father because I think they're dead, but anyway, that he goes to visit who is a professor but is so anti – is of the old guard and he feels shamed at that point that he's part of – he's in a sense sold himself out. I mean, this is what the character's about.
Yeah.
And that's the point of the story. That's the thematic element of the story, isn't it? That it's this contradiction or juxtaposition. I got all these academic between their love of the gaming, and the sort of rebellious nature of the gaming versus the mainstream aspect of the consumer. I think what I'm saying is I think it is critique the consumerism and the exploitation that gaming can bring. And what he wants to go back to is to that purer sense of being able to do it, you know, with their gaming clique. And yes, you're right.
So not everybody gets to do it.
So yes, you're right. It's a selfish decision.
That's something like not everybody gets to do it.
It's a selfish decision. Yeah, you're right. For me, that's not a deal breaker for the story.
No, it's not a deal breaker. It's just like, it's just one of these things. I really, look, the imagination.
It's an interesting discussion, though. Maybe, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the imagination in the stories is good.
Negative about what was my favorite. Well, no, I don't mean, I'm not having a crack. I'm just negative. I'm not having a crack. It's just, it was by far my favorite.
I really like
collection.
That. I love the augmented reality game. The things I loved about it, the pros was really, really clean. I really liked the imaginative sort of extrapolation of how technology can be grafted onto and how it's developing in our world.
Yeah.
And all that was really good. And, but, you know, they're niggling bits. And I think,
no, I'm not trying to shut you down. I mean, you've actually raised a point that I didn't think of.
And I think, you know, Tim Warren's a really good writer, and I think he'll just become a better writer. It just seemed that with these stories, they're very shiny and excited about, you know, the tech and the possibilities. And there's a lot of shiny, exciting possibilities. And they just seemed less willing to address some of the messier issues.
No, you're fair. No, that's fair. Right. And I think,
but overall, I enjoyed it. I really liked
the gender thing stuck out really to me.
And the gender
has not worked.
Yeah, and funnily enough, if there hadn't been the Mako character in that last, if she hadn't been there, if it'd just been another guy, it actually wouldn't have stuck out as much for me. You know, if it's just an all boy world, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But by making your only girl gamer this very stereotypical, pretty petite tantrum throwing Japanese cosplaying girl, when she's the only girl, it's a problem.
I agree with you 100%. I don't have it. it's the failing for me of that story, that issue. And I think you've raised a really good, I think the selfishness of Paul not being considered as such, but just, you're right, it's all happy endings.
It's just a very easy ending.
But
it's a poetic kind of a justice ending.
But if I had to look at this and compare to everything else we've read, and this is not an established author, this is someone starting out, so it's not Adam Roberts.
No, it's very...
The writing, and just the, I read this in a day, and what happened was I took it to lunch. I read it in a night and a day. I took it to lunch at work, and I actually missed I took 20 minutes longer at lunch because I had to finish it.
Yeah.
And that was not my experience except for the Adam Roberts, which is short anyway, of anything else.
I would probably put this and The Dark Wife as my two favourites of the ones we've read.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would buy anything by Tim, whether it's in this world or something else. I mean, I'm highly
interested in reading more.
Kirsten has raised important issues because...
They're just niggles, you know. I mean, when I think about it, it's like,
no, but some people take those niggles and make them into bigger things.
But because they are big things. Because the thing is, when I'm reading this book about these gamers in Cuba playing an augmented reality game with giant mecha robots rampaging through Havana, and it sounds awesome, and I think, wow, God, I'd love to do that, but there's no place for me because they're all boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the difference. It's the difference between, and there was no, you know, I mean, that's it. It's having a place for yourself there. Like, it's one thing to create these awesome, cool, shiny, exciting new worlds, but if you're not creating them with space enough for everyone, then you're creating divisions from the get-go.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's the failing of those three stories. It is only three because one of the disadvantages of doing only a few stories is that you don't get to explore everything you want to explore, but still.
But overall I really liked the collection. I like the triptych of stories.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm definitely interested in reading more of what Tim Warren writes.
We've been harsher on some books than others. But at the end of the day, for me, what it came down to is, does this person have the knack for storytelling?
Yeah.
And again, coming back to this idea that Adam Roberts raised, which we discussed in the last podcast about difficult writing, the Tim stuff was not difficult to read.
It's clean and beautiful.
But even,
and really
even
this, well even, integrated.
Even this discussion we're having, which is about the niggling, etc., is something that the story is raising. And in fact, I'll go back to Silence of Madea. That's the same thing. Even though I found the character to be dull, no character arc, it still has provoked discussion.
Yeah.
More than just this girl got raped and gets killed and it's terrible, which is really what Black Gods War about, or Angel Fall, which is just non-event. Is an absolute non-event.
And this is the thing,
The Dark Wife also provokes discussion. You've changed my view because I knocked it a bit more. And I actually Silence of Madea was the same, but I think you're right. Yeah, I don't think they're great. I think the Dark Wife's imperfect, and I think Silence of Madea need a lot of work. But the discussion can be provoked out of those works.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that we don't expect a book, and a book doesn't have to be perfect. It's all a balance. I mean, when we critique books, and often you end up talking about the stuff which maybe doesn't work as well, because that gives you a lot to talk about.
Which is what we've done with Tim's.
But I mean, for me, when I'm reading a book, I mean, and I can maybe count on one hand or less the number of books that I would think to be almost absolutely perfect in my life. So
can you name one?
No, actually, okay. Probably not. I'd have to really sit down and think. But what it comes down to is when you're reading a book is do the flaws, like the things that come up where you are, I don't know about that, I'm not sure about that. Is that outweighed by the stuff you're really enjoying or not? And that's really what it comes down to.
In the case of
and the more you're enjoying all the rest of the book,
yeah.
You know, whether that's the way it's written, whether it's a world building, the characters, the content, whatever it is, the more you get immersed in that, and to a great extent that is the skill of the author to pull you into their story.
And what I'm saying is I think Tim absolutely has that knack.
And that's it. And the more forgiving you can be of the little road bumps.
Which is why
I try. It's like, oh, that was a road bump. But you know what? I'm still enjoying the book. It hasn't thrown me into the ditch.
This is the – we could spend 5 hours on this, but this is the biggest problem about critiquing and people's responses to critiques and potential responses to this podcast, which is I loved Tim's book.
Yeah.
But my first reaction to you going on about Paul being selfish is to defend the book, actually when you put it in the way you've put it, and because you're so smart, you really do have a point. And I think
– But also I wasn't saying – sorry, continue.
No. And I think what happens is when we love something and someone else knocks it, we're just not capable in this world of internet and quick posts to step back and go, well, actually – doesn't actually kill my love of the book, but there actually is something in there.
Yeah.
And that was my reaction, immediate reaction to you in this discussion. Yeah. You know, but
and the thing is,
it doesn't mean that. Yeah.
And when I was talking about that, that didn't mean that I think, oh, this is crap then.
But that's what people assume.
I know.
You
and that's
one
the problem.
Thing,
but like I said, it's like,
and insecure writers think that too.
Yes. Well, everyone only ever remembers the bad stuff.
Yeah.
but this is what I mean. It's like when you know, it's like I was saying with the speed bumps. You're reading the book and you're traveling along this path that the writer's created for you, and they've landscaped it and they've built this beautiful road, and you're going along and it's windy and it's got dips and it's really good. And every so often there's this little speed bump, and sometimes it's just oh that was a bit uncomfortable, but hey, the rest of the road's really cool, so we'll keep going. And sometimes that throws you into the verge.
It's such a beautiful metaphor.
And, you know, that speed bumps are going to be different for different people.
Yeah, you're right. Some of these books had far too many. Well, the road was no good. The speed bumps.
I mean, for some people, they'll just skate over them and just go, oh, that was a bit bumpy. And for other people, go, oh, no, I'm gone. I'm out of this car.
Yeah. Yes.
So that is going to be different.
So what have we learned? We've done two podcasts on this. What have we learnt from self-published books?
I think we've learnt that editors, really good editors, have a place.
Didn't we already know this? Did we need to read these books to know this?
I didn't need to read the books to know this.
No. but we can at least say now with evidence and pointing at things and say, because, you know, usually people's gut reactions to go self-published, well, good, it needs an editor, it's all crap. Now we can say, well, no, it's not necessarily all crap.
It's not all crap.
Structural issues that don't get fixed up if you don't give it to someone.
I think some books are just bad books, and they're not salvageable. They're just bad books. They're not well written. It's a dull story. They're just not good books, and no amount of editing is going to save that book. And that's probably the vast majority of books that are ever written, whether they, you know, sit on someone's hard drive forever or get self-published or make it into mainstream publishing. Because I read a couple of those where I think, how the fuck did this get onto a bookshelf?
Yeah.
And then, you know. And that's all right. They're the ones you can kind of ignore and just say, never mind. They were just stillborn. They were never going to make it. It didn't matter. It's when you get a book like The Silence of Madea, where you think there's stuff in this book that's really interesting. And it needed another pair of hands. It needed someone
who wasn't
else
a friend, who wasn't part of a writing group,
who maybe wasn't getting paid to edit the book by the writer.
Oh, so you mean someone who? So someone who's doing it for gratis?
I mean, no. What I mean is, like, I mean, you can. I mean, you have to be really careful when you pick your editors if you are paying someone to edit your book. And there's a lot of really good freelance editors out there, and they do a good job. And, you know, the other problem is, and I'm not saying that's the case with any of these books we've reviewed because I don't know their history, but, you know, a freelance editor can do a really good job and send their editing report back to the author who's written the book and is the employer of that freelance editor for this manuscript. Yeah. And the author can go, I don't agree with any of that.
Yeah.
You're wrong, right? They can't do that to as much extent if the book is being published by a publishing house, because the publisher
will go.
Well,
they can, but they get into fights and and royalties get taken. Well, the advances get taken away.
But this is the thing. I mean, when you are the author, if you do go to the trouble of employing a freelance editor, it's hard to know when their editing report comes back, and if you don't agree with it, are you not agreeing with it because you're just too close to the book? Or were they just not a good editor? You know, you've got no third party there. You've got no third party who's standing there. It's hard. It's really hard. But I think this is the problem. If you have a book that's almost there and it's got good stuff in it, and the writing's good, but it needs a really, really good copy edit. Because there's too many adjectives or repetitions or whatever.
But the argument could be, well, throwing it out into the world via self-publishing at least gives me that feedback, but it could also destroy your career.
Well, I don't know if it's going to – well, you don't have a career, so there's nothing to destroy.
Well, not only in the sense of, is a publisher going to pick me up? Because I think ultimately some of these people, and possibly not Sarah Deamer, but others do want to be picked up by publishers. Now,
oh, no, Sarah Deamer said she wants to –
oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Actually, yes, you did say that. Yeah. But they want to be picked up by publishers. If you produced five or six self-published books that are risible.
Or you can write 50 Shades of Grey.
Fair point. No, fair point.
This is the thing. There's no, and nothing that we've said actually.
No, you're right.
Impacts anything in terms of the publishing landscape at the moment.
So ultimately, we shouldn't turn our nose up to this stuff.
No. You know,
some of it, a good majority of it might be complete and utter shizen. But at the same time, as everything, we knew this. We didn't have to read six books for me to make this fucking moral, moral of the story.
I read two books that I really quite liked. So that
so did I. I highly recommend Andy Copernicus and Paintwork. Yes, they're the books written by blokes. I'm sorry. Recommend with reservations The Dark Wife, which I've explained, and I would read something by Sarah Deamer again if it was recommended to me. I do not recommend The Silence of Madea, Angel Fall, or Black God's War. However, with The Silence of Madea, I think with a really good structural edit, that could have been a much better book.
The other two, they're really good ideas.
The other two, I just have no – well, yes.
A really good ideas in The Silence of Madea. It's one of those books where you think, this was almost.
Yeah.
It's like what you were saying the other month about, it's the blur short stories that really grind you down.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
Not the bad ones. The bad ones you can just throw away and go, whatever.
You mean what I said 2 months ago?
Oh, whenever you said it.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, it's the ones where you go, it was good. It was just not. Like
that's
it
right.
Could have been something, and they're the ones that are kind of depress you. They think they're but that's the thing. So I don't know. I think
will we do this again? Do you want to do this again?
Nope.
Okay. So never ever send out suggestions. We should though.
No, I'm happy to take suggestions.
No, I actually do want.
I think we should review our suggestion policy though. I think we should make it quite clear that we do not take.
Lukewarm.
Recommendations from authors for their own work. Please do not send us emails saying, I've written this book you might like.
Yes, we've had a few of those.
We don't do those kind of reviews.
No, that's number one. Number two is, if you are going to recommend to us, can you please A, have read it, and B, be absolutely besotted with it.
Okay.
So anyway.
Well, we've still got a couple of
them. Do we have prizes for our – because Cheryl Morgan's done well, 2 for 2.
Yeah, I think we could send Stephanie Cheryl Gunn's something. I'm happy to send Steph something. And
the rest can go jump. No. So that is the end of that.
No, actually, no, we should though. I mean, I think what I'll do is I'll get in touch with Cheryl and Stephanie. And they're the only two? Yes, I think so.
To be frank, yes. Sorry, Tahani. Sorry, Paul. And sorry, Jonathan.
Yeah.
I don't think – yeah, Jonathan gets enough books. He doesn't need any books.
Maybe we should just send Jonathan all our books that we don't want. Like,
you've got a huge pile of books.
I know. I could send them all to Jonathan in a huge packing container. So
you're going to spend possibly $2,500 sending books to him just
for
junk.
He made me read Angel Paul.
He didn't make you do anything. He didn't even recommend. He suggested, and good on him. Well done, Jonathan. Don't be ever frightened suggesting stuff to us. Just next time.
Read it.
Thank you. All right, let's end this.
Okay.
Because my family
I'm
sent
so
15
very
messages
glad
to
we
me
decided to split this into two.
Yes, I'm too. So next month.
Yes.
It's
a bit of a change of pace.
It is major change of pace. Again, there was a Twitter conversation about 400 years ago between Kirsten and I and Niall Harrison. And a couple of other people were involved. And Niall in particular said, "Will you do nonfiction?" And I said, "No fucking way. I hate that stuff." And Kirsten said,
"Sure, I've been wanting to read a book for ages. This is my excuse."
Correct. What are we recommending?
So the book that I have recommended is by Julie Phillips, and it's the James Tiptree Jr. biography, which is subtitled The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon.
The Galactic Suburbia have already done a review of this with Alex.
I don't care. We're going to talk about it for an hour.
Okay, great. That's a good one.
So that's my book.
And I thought I'd do something light and frothy. So I'm going with a Hugo-nominated Gary K. Wolfe book, Evaporating Genres. And I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. So one biography and one collection of essays.
Now, this means, because this is going up in November.
Yes.
That our mega literary podcast.
Yeah, we have an extension on that.
Well, we do Infinite Jest and the House of Leaves.
I think it'll be our January.
Is January.
So that's our light summer reading.
Yeah. We'll be in Perth with a House of Leaves trying to read that motherfucker. That'll be fun. All right. Anyway, so you could probably tell my voice is going. Please send feedback to you can follow us on Twitter, Writer and Critic. Comment at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. And as I said, we did get a comment on the previous episode about Silence of Medea, and I forgot the person who sent the comment. I should have checked that, but it doesn't matter. Please feel free to comment. Email at writerandcritic@gmail.com. I think there should be plenty of feedback on both these episodes.
We're very tired.
And yes, fuck, this has been a long, long time. And 5 stars on iTunes.
You were about to say Goodreads, weren't you?
And that too.
I think we're getting 1 star on Goodreads.
Negative stars. So with that, this has been an experience which we'll never repeat. No, this has been great. And
it's not – can I just point out that part of the arduousness of this was actually just reading and talking about 6 books in a month. Reading them in a month and talking about them in like –
in an evening.
An evening. Yes. So that was part of the arduousness.
Yes. So if we did seem to fade or just talk shit for 25 minutes towards the end of this podcast, it's because it's been a long night.
It's been a long night.
All right, I'm off.
Okay.
I'm going home.
I'll see you next month.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. I bought my first real 6-string at the 5 and Dime. Played it till my fingers bled. Was the summer of 69. Me and some guy from school had a band and we tried real hard. Jimmy quit, Jody got married. This podcast is Hugo worthy. Oh, when I look back now, boom, boom. The summer seemed to last forever. And if I had the chance, yeah, I'd wanna be there. Those were the best days of my life. Take that, self-published novels.